Good morning, Boker Tov. Welcome back. Glad to see everybody. We're going to be learning today. Today is a special share which is sponsored for the memory of a number of very special people. I'd like to start off by thanking Annie and Chaim Bernstein, who are sponsoring this share for the yard site of Annie's father, Mr. Bernard Michel Dov Berish Ben Meir Olav Hashalom. This is now 3 years. This is the third yard site which is coming up. And Baruch Hashem, in the meantime, we have two namesakes are, well, it's Boy Bayom, the Boy Bayom yard site. We have two namesakes already, Baruch Hashem, Echeni Yirbu, of remembering a very special human being, a person who built a very special family. And I have the schus of being with the family through that time and learning just how incredible a human being he was and continues to be through his family. We are also learning this week, Lila Nishmas Gittel Bas Israel Baruch of San Diego, sponsored by Becky and Yaakov Doretsky, who just passed away this last week, an incredible human being, one of the pillars of the San Diego community. And we are going to learn the Ilu Nishmasa. We are also learning for the Yartzal of Susan Cohen's mother, Mrs. Esther Wandt, Esther Hindabas Meir Oizer Alea Shalom, which will be tomorrow. And the Yartzal will be on February 17th. It should be Aliyas in Nishmasa. She was a human being who was a very responsible human being. She made, when Susan and Murray were engaged, she made sure that Susan finished college before they got married, with a year and a half engagement. A human being who was very much involved in the Young Israel world, which is why Murray and Susan actually joined the Young Israel Brooklyn, and when they came out to the five towns, they joined the Young Israel here, which had been founding foundational members for years since. And we also thank Karen and Michael Rosenblum, who are sponsoring. This is really the first Yotza. Can you believe this? Is Karen here? Is Karen here? I didn't see Karen yet. Karen's not here yet. For Karen's mother, Mrs. Bunny Sands, Razel Bas Mendel HaKohen Aleha Shalom, Tammy and Karen's mother, and we think so fondly back to the wonderful memories, and we look forward to many continued smachos, God willing, in the mishpacha. Thank you for making the shir the destination and the venue of this learning. We are going to be learning a topic which I just want to admit at the beginning is a very difficult topic, and the reason why it happens at this particular juncture in time is not thematically connected to any specific moment. Although yes, it was the International Holocaust Memorial Day just at the end of January, January 27th, and that's when people were talking about this. It happens to be I was invited this last Friday to help to 8th grade to address the 8th grade children or kids who had been involved in a program called Names Not Numbers. And I was at the end of the program. It was a 6-week program in which they'd learned a lot about the Holocaust, the stories of the Holocaust, and they'd finally did their interviews this last Wednesday with Holocaust survivors. And this is the debriefing on the Emunah side. So you can imagine that's a bit of a tall order. That's a very difficult conversation to have. And I would like to share. I felt that the ideas are so pertinent and so relevant that it might be worthwhile trying to understand them a little bit more in context. So that's our goal. I'd like to develop the ideas in a more sophisticated fashion, just because of the nature of the crowd, and also to appreciate some of these ideas. I feel like a lot of these. When I was speaking to these young men and women, I asked them how many of them in their families had survivors, and really a majority of the kids had great-grandparents who were survivors, which makes sense because the program is self-selected. You have to apply to the program and be accepted. So it was specifically those kids who were very interested in learning more who took the time to be involved, and it's really impressive to see that the continuation of the conversation. So I'd like to think about this from a number of perspectives, and just looking at the chevra here, just by a show of hands, who here does have somebody in the family, who's been through it? Okay, so a number of people who whether it be parents or other relatives who've been through the Holocaust. So let's just with all seriousness, let's try to appreciate this topic. And obviously, there's much more to talk about, but just a few perspectives to be shared. So we're going to start off just a pasuk actually said yesterday, fascinating pasuk that the Torah talks about, the Aseret HaDibros. We're all standing at this point in time in Shul, and we're about to hear Anochi Hashem Elokecha. But before that, there's one pasuk, and the pasuk says, "Ovaydaber Hashem Elokim El Eskol Adverim Ha'Eleh Lemor." Hashem spoke all these matters, saying. So now, generally speaking, the word le'mor is a curious word in Tanakh, because we usually hear it in the following context. Usually we hear it in the context of Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe, le'mor. Hashem spoke to Moshe. What does le'mor literally mean then?
Saying.
So who's the saying? What's it supposed to mean? It's supposed to be Moshe Rabbeinu. You're going to be the agent to say it. There's going to be a number of people you're going to have to tell about this, so you are going to repeat it over to the rest of Klal Yisrael. Here's the issue. What's the problem in this pasuk? Who's the audience? The audience over here is? All of Klal Yisrael. It's not Moshe. That's the whole point. This is national revelation. This means to say, unlike any other religion at any point in any time in history, never has there ever been a claim of national revelation, except for once, and that's at Har Sinai. Any other prophet, Muhammad, right, Yoshka, they all came back. They had private meetings with God, right? We are all the beneficiaries of their private meeting being relayed to us afterwards. There's only one other time in history when anybody's ever claimed that there's been one national revelation where everybody heard it, and this is Matan Torah, right? And certainly at least for the first two, maybe all ten, depending on the version that the Gemara says. Which means, who's the audience? Klal Yisrael. That's the next pasuk is on Echeshem Akecha. So who's the Leimor? That's the question. Meaning, I understand, when Moshe Rabbeinu is having the meeting with Hashem, and he says Leimor, then yes, Moshe Rabbeinu is going to tell him, this is the laws of Shemitah. Bahar Sinai, Leimor, right? I understand. But when it comes to this, there's no Leimor. Who is he telling this to? Says the Mishnah, what was that?
The next generation.
Ah, so says the Mishnah Chachma. We don't believe in God because of incredible miracles that happened throughout history. After all, many wonderful miracles have happened, and many people have ignored them. Or forgotten them very quickly. You know why we believe? We believe because of tradition. And that's because my parents told me the same thing that my grandparents told them. And they listened because my great-grandparents told them the same thing all the way back. This started off at the beginning because of Le'mor. You want to understand Torah? You want to know why we're connected to it, even though we weren't necessarily there physically? Is because Le'mor. Is because it started with a group of Klal Yisrael who continued to say it over to their children, and we are the end of that chain, which means that we have a responsibility to continue to talk about it. And not just it, but even the high parts and the low parts of it. So we're going to try to address some of the lower parts of that conversation today. So there's a number of different ways of addressing this, different ways and perspective. I think that perhaps to go in the deep end, it might be worthwhile to approach us from the deep end, because it's so heavy, and then perhaps try to alleviate the pressure a little bit. So for those who've ever read any of Elie Wiesel's work, Elie Wiesel wrote a number of books. One of the autobiographical books was a book called Night, and it's actually his own experiences in the Holocaust. It was part of a trilogy later on that he expanded. It's very heavy. It's very heavy to read. And actually, a number of years ago, if you remember, we actually, in this year, upon his death, it was just, I think, 2 years ago now, we went through some of the perspectives of Night from a Torah perspective. But he has a story in there which we did not address last time. And the story is, it's a very disturbing story, where he's actually at this point in a work camp. And it was a tremendous pressure. They had to work extremely hard. But there was from time to time, there would be accusations made against certain camp inmates who were doing activities which were considered treacherous, and they were put to death. And there was one instance in which, whether it be disobedience, whether it be gathering arms, planning resistance, there was one instance in which there was an accusation, there was an underground collection of arms which was found, and they traced it back, and they found that there were three perpetrators, and one of them was the assistant to one of the capos, and this was a young boy, who was found accused, and they were very scared. The SS themselves were scared because they knew that to put to death a child in front of thousands of people is a terrifying thing. And he describes how they were brought to the square in the middle of the camp, and they set up a black gallows in the middle of the camp, and they put these three people, two adults and this young boy in the middle, and they read out the accusation, and they ask everybody to remove their hats, and they kick the chairs. And the way they used to do it in this camp was that what they would do is they would make all the inmates line up and walk past right in front of the people who had just been killed to look them in the face, and then go back to their barracks in order to scare off anybody from further crime. And he describes in the most terrible detail, and we're not going to read it, but he describes in the detail that the two men on either side were dead. They were clearly dead, and the child was not dead yet because he was too light to be dead. It took him an hour to die on the gallows. And he says, as he walked in front of this child, he heard somebody whispering behind him, and this is the quote is, "For God's sake, where is God?" And from within me, I heard a voice answer, "Where is he? There is where, hanging here from the gallows." That night, the soup tasted of corpses. That's the way that Elie Wiesel describes it. That's a very, very heavy, heavy statement. And I'd like to sort of start, and this is a very dark place to start, but I think that it's worthwhile trying to address this. And by the way, he himself addresses it. If you read the new introduction tonight, he addresses it. I'd like to come back to that in a moment of how he addresses the statement. And what he was essentially saying, if you think about this from the perspective of the person witnessing this and experiencing this, is how could it be? How it doesn't work together to have HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who we say is an Ava Rachaman, and to see this happen. There's no way that you can put those two ideas together. There's no way to be able to reconcile the two. And at the same time, ironically, to a certain degree, he was right. And I'd like to explain why he was right. There was a sefer written, a very powerful sefer written by the Eish Kodesh, the Rav Kleinus Kalman Shapira, which was written, it was actually a collection of the essays, or not the essays, the drashas given in the Warsaw Ghetto by Rav Shapira. Rav Shapira was a Polish Rav of immense stature. He was an educator by nature. He wrote a number of Sfarim, very famously, one of the Feldheim translated is Choves HaTalmidim. It's really worthwhile, a remarkable individual. And he lived through the suffering, and he lost numerous family members throughout the Warsaw Ghetto. And he wrote, actually Dr. Abramson, who's in our shul, wrote a book called Torah from the Years of Wrath about the notes on the Eish Kodesh, some of the annotations. A lot of the literature has been dedicated to that. He buried his notes in a milk can under the Warsaw Ghetto. The entire Warsaw Ghetto was leveled afterwards, and they were able to reconfigure them, and it's published, and you can read it's a short sefer of his drasha. It's very, very emotive, and he uses emunah, he uses the drasha as a way of expressing his struggle, and he struggled. He really struggled. Ultimately, he died after the ghetto, and his legacy is this, and right now, of course, there's Eish Kodesh in Woodmere, which is named after his sefer, and in Eretz Yisrael, he actually has, I believe, a nephew or grandnephew who has a shul in Ramat Beit Shemesh called Eish Kodesh, also very much focused on education. If everybody's been there, he gets the children very much involved, very special individual, also part of the Pizadzada dynasty. Yes?
Josh's grandmother's first cousin was the Eish Kodesh.
Unbelievable. So, Mamish, right, it says a lot, this is directly into this room right here, is we have the bloodline, which is just an incredible thing. What a remarkable human being. And he, by the way, he did not gloss over things. He did not try to avoid these things. But one of the things he did when he said was towards the end in Shabbos Nachamu, he says the following. This is one of the translations of it, and I actually have the larger section, so I'm not sure how much you have over here. I can just borrow just to see the source number. This is on the bottom of page 2. So Psiatz Nereba says the following. The bottom of page 2, he says the very reason Hashem appeared to Moshe for the first time from within the burning bush. Rashi explains the choice of the thorn bush by quoting the verse, "Emoi anachi v'tzara." So Hashem says, why was he appearing in the fire of the thorn bush? It was because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was with them in the pain. And he goes on to describe the Gemara Chagiga Daf Hem Beis, which talks about HaKadosh Baruch Hu is nimtza, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whether HaKadosh Baruch Hu weeps or doesn't weep. There's different psukim which are austere to that. Does HaKadosh Baruch Hu weep or not? And the Gemara says, "Bachadre gavai," in the inner chambers, that's where HaKadosh Baruch Hu weeps. In the outer chambers, "Hoid v'hadar lefonov," that he looks, that is splendor. So where is it you find HaKadosh Baruch Hu weeps? By Mistarim, in the hidden places. What the Eish Kodesh is trying to say is, where is HaKadosh Baruch Hu found? The answer is, like Elie Wiesel said, on the gallows as well. Which means, think about what he's saying. The Eish Kodesh talks about immeasurable human suffering that he's witnessing. We just watched a documentary around November time, around the Kristallnacht, which was called Who Will Write Our History. If you've not watched it, you should watch it. It's about the Warsaw Ghetto, the immeasurable suffering of during the Warsaw Ghetto, there are people dying on a daily basis. He was in there, and he was witnessing that. And as he was witnessing that, the drasha he says is that why is Hashem appearing as a burning thorn bush? Is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is showing that throughout all of history, through all the burnings and all the incinerations and all the auto dufes and all the holocausts of history, where is HaKadosh Baruch Hu? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not, the model is not, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, where is he? He's on the side watching and abandoning. He's really actually found within the human spirit and suffering with the human spirit along with them. That's what the Eish Kodesh was saying. Do we have the right to say that? No. Does he have the right to say that? Yes. And this is where, in a certain sense, the irony is that Kodesh Baruch Hu is suffering along with Klal Yisrael there. He is suffering through them and with them. Just to perhaps shift it as ever so slightly in a different direction, that's what the Eish Kodesh's perspective. There was once a speech given by Rabbi Yehuda Amital. Are you familiar? Rabbi Yehuda Amital, we should be familiar. Rabbi Amital was the founding Rosh Hashiva of Yeshivas Har Etzion in Alon Shvut, and he was a remarkable individual on so many levels. One of his hallmark characteristics was his humility. He's a humble human being. He actually invited Rav Lichtenstein to be the co-Rosh Hashiva with him. Just, you don't see Rosh Hashiva, you're like inviting. And then later on, at the end of his life, he actually initiated the next 3-4 Rosh Hashiva during his lifetime to initiate them so everybody would know who the continuation is. A very, very remarkable human being. He lived through the Holocaust himself, and he discusses his struggles in Emunah. He discusses it openly, and he's not glib about it. He doesn't slide it under the carpet. He says a very powerful thing. In this essay, he does not go in exactly the same direction as the Eish Kodesh, but he says the following. He says, "Look," I was reading Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler wrote before the Holocaust in Mechtam Eliyahu that the yisoid of all tefillah, that the basis of all tefillah is gratitude. When we come in front of HaKadosh Baruch, we pour out our hearts in gratitude to Him. So he says, "Well, the problem is that let me tell you the experience that I had after the Holocaust in a cramped basement." With survivors on all sides who were trying to daven. He says there was no way any of us could muster anything, not even a tenth of a tenth of a hundredth of gratitude in our tefillah. That wasn't the basis of our tefillah. So what was the basis of our tefillah then? Where was there space to even daven? What wellspring could we pull that out of if all of davening is based on gratitude? And so he says it wasn't based on gratitude. In fact, he quotes the famous Gemara, where it says, the Gemara says that why were Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, called the Great Assembly? Just it should be Anshei Knesset, right? It should just be the people of the assembly. Why was it called the Great Assembly? He says, because they reinstituted something which was lost. What was lost? It says, at the times of Yirmiyahu and Daniel, they stopped saying certain words in the davening. Moshe Rabbeinu says, Hakel HaGadol HaGibor V'Anora, that's the language that Moshe Rabbeinu uses to praise Hashem. We adopt that in the Shemoneh Esrei as the beginning of Elokeinu Elokei Oseinu, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, Hakel HaGadol HaGibor V'Anora. Those are the words that Moshe Rabbeinu used. But during the times of Yirmiyahu says, I can't say HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Gibor, right? Because how could it be that Bnei Yisrael are suffering so, and I'm describing HaKadosh Baruch Hu as strong. So he himself had this crisis of faith, and he couldn't bring himself to say the word Gibor about Hashem. And then when it came to Daniel, who's living in the Babylonian and then Persian goddess, says, I can't bring myself to say the word Nairah. Awesome, fearful, because how could it be that his children are suffering such? And now think about the honesty of that struggle. I can't dishonestly say how I can dive into Hashem when that the words don't match up with the experience that I'm experiencing. So therefore, came along Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, who lived at the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, which was no party by itself. It was a complicated time, even though there was a little bit of a reprieve. It was a time wrought with difficulty. And they said, you know what, we're going to reinstitute those words. Why? Why? They brought them back into the liturgy, or they actually created the liturgy. And the reason is because where is the Gvura and the Noraos of Hashem? Where is the power of Hashem seen? In the fact that we weren't destroyed. Meaning, yes, oppressed, not destroyed. That a keves is nimtsa ben shivim za'evim, that a lamb is found among 70 wolves and is not torn asunder. That is the place where you see the Noraos of Hashem. Not in the powerful fireworks and destroying the enemy, but through the preservation of the seed of Jacob. That's the way they saw it, and that's how they reinstituted it. So he talks about how he himself struggles the same struggle. How can he daven, having seen this? How there's no gratitude, there's no space for that. Where is the space for this? And he says, he quotes a pasuk in Iyov, never chance to put into the sources, but he says a pasuk in Iyov perek yud gimel per pasuk tes vav. Says the following: Hein yikteleni loy ayachel. Let's look at those words for a moment. Remember, Iyov representing the greatest of suffering. Hein yikteleni means, behold, what's yikteleni? He will kill me. Loi ayachel. What does that mean? Loi to him, ayachel. I will. It's a Kriya Ksiv. Excellent, Elliot. Loi ayachel. I will hope in him. Which means, though it's generally understood, even if he brings me to death, I will still hope in him. Interestingly enough, as Elliot pointed out, it is a Kriya Ksiv, which means the text actually writes, Lamed Aleph. Loi ayachel. Meaning, I will not. The Kree, the way we read it, as the mission in Sota points out, is to him I will hope. Which means, says Rav Amital, we ran away from Hashem to Hashem. That's the way he puts it. We ran away from Hashem to Hashem because there was nowhere else to go. That's the way he puts it. Just a profound analysis over here. Very real. Very, very real. He says, ultimately, the bond of love between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so deep that even as we run from him, we run to him at the same time. That was the way he expressed it. Very, very profound, very, very painful to read. It's worth actually reading his entire essay on this. But I'd like to pivot away a little bit from these perspectives into something which I actually feel is somewhat a little more hopeful and more general a perspective. These are very dark perspectives, the Eish Kodesh and Rav Amital. But there's another way of looking at this altogether. Let's take that idea of the Eish Kodesh for a moment. The Eish Kodesh was essentially saying that the spirit of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is found within the human being themselves, essentially, right? Meaning in the human suffering is where is Hashem is suffering. I'd like to turn that idea just around a little bit in a different perspective. And here's how it goes. It actually, Amital mentions this in his essay. And he says, talks about a conversation that he has with a man by the name of Abba Kovner, who was a poet. He was involved in the Vilna Ghetto uprising, and he said the following. It's such a powerful line. If you have it in the sources, it's just under Amital, the emboldened section. He says, I once had a conversation with Abba Kovner, may he rest in peace. He was a leader of the revolt in the Vilna Ghetto and an important Hebrew poet. I said to him, I don't know whose test was greater, mine or yours. Your banner was faith in man. After the Shoah, can you still believe in man? I believe in God, whom I cannot understand, but man should be fathomable. So what do you believe in now? Meaning, I can't understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but I know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is infathomable. But you believed in man. What are you left to believe in now? Is there any goodness left in humanity? This comment is so powerful because it brings us back to just a very basic idea. And that is the following. As we read Sefer Bereishis, and we read about the 6 days of creation, it's fascinating. When you read all the days of creation, almost every day has a moment in time where HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Vayar Hashem, Kitoiv, it was good. Yes, of course, Monday and then double life God Tuesday is different. But come to day six, it's fascinating. What happens at the very, very end? HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns to the creation. He creates all the animals. And then it says, after creating all of these animals on day six, Vayar Elohim Kitoiv, God saw it was good. And then he creates man. And then he creates man. Now, truth be told, at the end it says, Vayar Hashem Kitov Ma'od. It's called Asa Kitov Ma'od. But let's appreciate this for a moment. What is the deal over here? HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes the Vayar Hashem Kitov, which usually belongs at the end of the creation of that day, and he moves it earlier after the entire creation of the kingdom of Fauna, with the exception of humanity, and says, Vayar Hashem Kitov. What is he saying, essentially? So when it comes to human being, is man good? The answer is not no or yes. The answer is, we don't know yet. Right, well, that's going to be in a few generations. At this point in time, there is man good, is humankind good or bad? The answer is, we don't know. The jury is out. Let's wait and see. Let's see what they do with their lives. In fact, even at the end when it says, Vayar Hashem is kol asher asa v'yinei tov ma'od, what does Chazal say? Ma'od means the Yetzara, evil, which means, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, when I've created human beings, I've now instilled in a creature the ability to choose. Now, so when you see the lion, which is going and wantonly killing the leopard or the cheetah for no reason, I understand. Akash Baruch Hu, you pre-programmed that. That was the way you created a beast which was of such power. But the lion is not choosing. The lion is simply weighing different instincts against each other. Whether it be territory, whether it be protection of children, whether it be food, whatever those instincts are, there's going to be a certain triage that is pre-programmed in the lion, and they will act in certain ways given the certain situations. However, a human being is not like that. A human being can make decisions. And because a human being can make decisions, then there is no kitov off the bat. There is no good necessarily inherent in a human being until a human being proves that they're actually good. Until human sublimates their free will to become like a animal in the good way. That's the what's waiting over here. The way it's expressed in the Gemara in Sanhedrin is the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to the angels, Na'aseh Adam, that's one of the explanations of why it's in plural. And he turns to the angels and he says, should I make human beings? And the angels said, well, tell us about him. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, well, there's going to be World War I and there's going to be World War II. And the angel said, no, thank you. So then he destroyed the angels. He turned to a new group of angels and he says, Na'aseh Adam. And the angel said, tell us a little bit. So he says, well, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be this country called China, and that's what they're going to do with all the religions. And they said, no, thank you. And so then he created a third group of angels, and he said, should I create humanity? And the angel said, look, you obviously want to create humanity. Now, obviously, this is not a dialogue as we understand it, but he says, you want to create humanity, so create humanity. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created humanity, and then it says, comes the Dor HaMavol. And Hashem was disappointed by Yisatzev Eliboy, at the end of Parshas Bereishis, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, by Nochem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yes, the experiment, giving a creature the free will to make creation and destruction, is a very dangerous game. And ultimately, giving that space, that tzimtzum for that decision making, leads to very interesting results, very terrifying results. In the way that Rabbi Sacks says it in a beautiful essay he wrote just a few years ago, in an essay on Bereishis called Faith of God, he says the following. This is a very powerful statement, which is the following under Rabbi Sacks. It says, when I first stood at Auschwitz-Birkenau, the question that haunted me was not, where was God? God was in command. God was in the command, you shall not murder. God was in the words, you shall not oppress the stranger. God was saying to humanity, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. God did not stop the first human beings eating forbidden fruit. He did not stop Cain committing murder. He did not stop the Egyptians enslaving the Israelites. God does not save us from ourselves. That, according to the Talmud, is why creating man was such a risk that the angels advised against it. The question that haunts me after the Holocaust, as it does today in this new age of chaos, is where is man? Now think about that for a moment, what that means. If you think about it, it comes down to the same kernel that the Esh Kodesh was saying, in essence. Where is HaKadosh Baruch Hu? HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows him to be in the platform of humanity. Is that good or not? Well, it depends what the human being decides. The human being can decide to act based on those heavenly principles and express God in the world, or close off that sluice and decide to be a completely wantonly destructive creature, losing even the title of humanity by doing so. That's what the human being has the choice to make. Now, that comes back to Abakovna's discussion with Rav Amital. He says, you believed in man. Where's man? How do you believe in man anymore? After you see what they did. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had principles. He left it up to us to work it out. Just to give you a sense of just how deep this is, how powerful this is. The story is told in the Mimam HaKim. Rav Ephraim Oshri in his Shuvas Mimam HaKim writes the following. This was in Ukraine. Most people think, you know, oh, the final solution. You know, that was when things went bad. It's like, no. I've got to read about Eastern Europe before. The final solution was just because that the mass killings were going too slowly and it was taking too much money to waste bullets. But when you read about the Einsatzgruppen, when you read about the four sets of groups that were sent out into Ukraine to murder Jews en masse, you've got to read this book by Patrick Dubois called Holocaust by Bullets, just to read the literature to see what was going on in that era. There was a certain village which the Einsatzgruppen arrived at. That would be generally Nazis and Ukrainian collaborators. And they would bring out the entire town to the forest and they'd make them dig pits and essentially mow them down into the pits and then bury them. There'd be mass throughout Ukraine. It's one cemetery, essentially, the entire area. And he describes how, you know, the Jews of a particular village were taken out to this area not so far from the town. And you know, although they themselves had not been there before, but, you know, there were the piles of clothes on the side, there was machine guns mounted on the tripods along the sides of the ditch, it was obvious what was about to happen. The Rav of the town turns to the Nazi commander and he says, "Don't you believe that there at least people have a last prayer that they can say?" And he says, "Go ahead, say what you want." And so he turned to all of the group, and he does vidui with them. He does vidui with his kehillah, and then he says, "And imagine, what would you say? What tefillah would you say?" And he says, "You think Shema Yisrael?" And you know what he said? He asked everybody to repeat after him. He says, "Baruch Atah Hashem Lekein Melech Olam, Shaloi Osani Goy." And the man said, Nazi said, "So tell me, what do you say, Jew?" And he said, "I said a prayer that I'm thankful that I'm not a German." And the man started laughing. He said, "Yeah, well, if you're so thankful, then why are you in the pit?" And the way he answered it is the following. He says, "You know, for whatever reason God has decreed, some will be murdered and some will be murderers. We are blessed that we are not to be murderers." Think about that. Think about that. What was Rav Amital saying? Is where is the evil that exists in the Holocaust was in the human spirit. Thank you, Hashem, for not making us this. Now I'd like to just, if that's the focus, I'd like to just tease out a few specific instances where we see that flame of Hashem in the Holocaust, in the most incredible human beings that lived. As examples, some of the heroes, and there's many, so many, but just a few examples. There's a man by the name of Rav Yosef Kahaneman. Rav Yosef Shlomo Kahaneman. Anybody have a chance to meet him? Anybody here have a chance to meet Rav Kahaneman? Abby. Had a chance to meet an unbelievable human being, the Ponovitcher Rav. The Ponovitcher Rav left Ponovitch in Lithuania. Happened to be out at the time the war started, and ultimately lost 9 children, his wife, his entire family, his yeshiva. And he was the one who was in Palestine. He was in Israel at the time, during the Second World War, and he had this dream. He went to a desert area outside of Tel Aviv, where the Chazon Ish was living, and he said, "You know what, we're going to, on this little mound of dust, we're going to make this thing called the Ponovitch Yeshiva." And everybody said, "Nebuch, the suffering, the loss, his family, his community, he must have gone out of his mind." You know, and he didn't stop, and he carried on building, and he carried on building, and he carried on building, and he laid the cornerstone of the Yeshiva. And they asked, and they said to him, "How in the world?" And by the way, today, if you go to Bnei Brak, the center of Bnei Brak, the epicenter of Bnei Brak is the Ponovitch Yeshiva. You walk up those stairs to the Ponovitch Yeshiva where thousands of people are learning Torah today. That whole city was based on the dream of one person who had lost everything. And by the way, I believe he was in his 60s at the time, or late 50s or 60s at the time. So we're not talking about a restarting business here. We're talking about it for nothing. And they once asked him, and there was many times they asked him different ways. It's a remarkable, remarkable human being. They asked him, where did you get that resilience? And he said, when I was a young boy, when I was 7 years old, listen to this story. When I was 7 years old, there was the winter, and it was the time for cheder to start. And my mother said that one of us can go to cheder because there's only one set of boots to get through the snow, to get to the shul, to get to the cheder, to learn Torah. And we all wanted to go. There was 4 brothers in line, so he had 3 older brothers who wanted to go to cheder, and they all wanted to. So she said, "I'll make a lottery. Whoever davens the best, says their bracha is the best, and says kriyas shema l'emet to the best, will win the lottery and get the boots to go to yeshiva tomorrow, and to cheder tomorrow." And you can imagine they're all belting it out, and the walls were shaking, and the windows were vibrating as they did their brachas and their kriyas shema that night. And the next morning at 5 a.m., the oldest of the brothers woken up by the mother. She picks him up, she bundles him up, gives him a little food, and she walks in the snow, which at this point in time is 5 feet. It's supposed to be a 15-minute walk. It takes her 20, 25 minutes. Walks to the shul, which is now the heat is on, and she puts him down and comes back. And she does this for each of the children. And at this point in time, time past seven, she picks up little Yoska, and she says, and he says, "Mama," he says, "who won the lottery? Did I win it?" And she says, no, I won the lottery. She used the boots. And so she takes him to the shul, and she says the following. He says to her, "Mama," he says, "you carried us in the ice and the snow to learn Torah, Mama. You'll see, I will bring you many boys to learn Torah for you, Mama, for you." He said the foundation stone of Ponovitch was built on the shoulders of his mother. That's why he said he built the yeshiva. Now, think about that for a moment. A person lost absolutely everything. At this point in time, it's time to throw in the towel. At this point in time, it's time to say, that's it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I tried, you took away, that's it. And in the end of the day, this human being, the resilience of the human spirit, let's take it one step further, in a different example of this. The Blujov Rebbe, Rav Yisrael Spira, who went through the Holocaust, one of the incredible spiritual leaders who went through the Holocaust, describes the following story. This is a terrifying moment. He describes how he was in a work camp called Yanoshka, where what would happen is that they would bring in a large amount of the work was they'd have to saw down trees, and if you weren't sawing the quota, you'd be killed. And he described how there was new arrivals every day, and there was a woman who was in the crowd, and she was carrying a bundle. The bundle was obviously a baby, and she starts asking around as she arrives at the camp. She starts asking everybody, does anybody have a knife? And so he realized what she was asking, and so he went over to her and he says, just have strength, have hope, don't do anything, it's not worth it, just pray, just wait, don't do anything. She doesn't listen to him, she starts asking around, obviously nobody has a knife, so she goes up to the Nazi officer and he says, do you have a knife? And understanding what she's asking, he smiled and he pulled out the knife off his belt and he gives it to her. Sadistic creature. At which time she puts the bundle on the ground, she opens up the blankets, and she says the bracha of Hamila, and she does a bris milah on her child. And then she gives the knife, the bloody knife, back to the Nazi, and she says, I know we're both going to die, but at least when I return my child to the Borei Olam, he will have done the mitzvah of milah. Now think about this for a second. Where in the wildest of dreams do you find the resilience and the goodness of human spirit to be able to do that? Where in the wildest of dreams can that exist? Another example, again, the Blujov Rebbe. This was a religious woman, a non-religious man, came to Yom Kippur in 1942, Yanoshka, the work camp. And this is actually related in Yaffa Eliach Aleha Shalom's book, Chassidic Tales of the Holocaust. She describes about how it was coming Yom Kippur and the Blujov Rebbe didn't want to work on Yom Kippur. So he tried, he wanted to ask that be given a task which wouldn't involve Melacha on Yom Kippur. The problem was that the person above him was a person by the name of Shneur Weiss, who in his previous days wasn't just a non-religious person, he was an irreligious individual, he was a person who despised and hated religious Jewry. So he realized that he was putting himself at a risk, because if you were to ask this man, he essentially identifies himself as a religious Jew and therefore has now identified himself for worse treatment. But at the same time, it's Yom Kippur, and this might be the last Yom Kippur of his life. So what does he do? Finally, he decided that he was going to ask that he and his little group be put to work in a better place just for that day of Yom Kippur, that they won't have to do this. The man turned, he says, I'm the Rav of Prushnik. He says, I'm a Jew like yourself. Please, just tomorrow is Yom Kippur. We don't want to work. Can you help us work in a way that doesn't avoid the biblical melacha, melacha midaraisa? The man listened. He turned to me and says, I promise you, as long as you live, it'll be a good life. But I beg you to do for us what we still find some dignity in the humiliating existence. The man listened, and he says, I can't do anything tonight. He says, tomorrow I'll see. So he said the next day, he took him to an office in the Nazi office, and he allowed them to start pretending to clean the floor. So they had dry rags, and he allowed them to sort of do it in a way that wasn't obvious, that they weren't working. And the Rav Spiro was on the ladder. He was pretending to clean a window, and into the room walks two Nazi officers. And they had one of those push carts. On the push cart was filled with steaming food, soup and meat. Realizing it was Yom Kippur, they turned to them and said, Nu yidin fress, eat. That's the only time they've ever seen food like that in the past number of years. And so the men responded and said, nobody responded, everybody was quiet. So they turned to Shneur Weiss, who of course was the leader, and they said to him, he said, here's a Jewish dog, eat. And so very quietly he said, today is Yom Kippur, it's the holiest day of the year, we don't eat today. So the man pulled out a revolver and pointed at his head and he said, in the name of the Führer of the Third Reich, you will eat. And Shneur Weiss very calmly responded and said, we Jews obey the laws of tradition, today is Yom Kippur, the day of fasting. At which point, he shot him in the head, killing him on the spot. Rav Spiro, who was on the ladder, made the following comment. He says, Shneemas, the man who in the past had publicly transgressed against Jewish tradition, had sanctified God's name publicly and died a martyr's death for the sake of Jewish honor. Only then, on that Yom Kippur day in Yanoshka, said the rabbi to the Hasidim, did I understand the meaning of the statement in the Talmud, even the transgressors in Israel are as full of good deeds as a pomegranate is filled with seeds. So you say, where is HaKadosh Baruch Hu? The answer is, in the greatest of spirits of thousands upon thousands of nameless individuals who suffered and sacrificed themselves all the way through. That's where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is found. And where is he not found? He is not found in those people who started off as human beings and decided that Ki Tov was not an appellation that they were ever going to take for themselves and their nation. One last perspective. And this is as we move into Rav Soloveitchik, and this is the following. Rav Soloveitchik has an essay called Kol Dodi Dofek. We most famously know this essay because it talks about Israel. But the essay is not about Israel. The speech which he gave in Yiddish in Namport Auditorium in 1956 was in fact about the Holocaust. It happens to be that as he moves out of the Holocaust, he moves into Eretz Yisrael, he moves into the Shesh Defekos, the six knocks, and that's the part which is more famous. The first part of it is about Eov, about suffering. And here's what he says. I don't know how much we have in the actual notes. I want to see where I put in the notes over here. So it's actually a very, very, very beautiful description. He says, after the psychic quaking of the sufferer, again, this is a translation of Yiddish into English, which comes this is available online, it's worthwhile reading the entire thing. He says, which first comes as a reaction to suffering, comes the intellectual curiosity of the sufferer, which seeks to understand existence and to strengthen the sufferer's safety and security. At this stage, man begins to examine suffering and ask weighty questions. He searches for the rational foundations of suffering and evil, and endeavors and try to find tranquility and harmony that lie between the positive and negative, and thus to remove the edge of the tension between the thesis good and the antithesis evil of existence. From the question and the inquiry, the solution and the answer, he arrives at a metaphysical formulation of evil, through which he comes to terms with evil and attempts to gloss it over. The sufferer employs the power of rational abstraction with which the Creator endowed him to point to the point of self-deception, the denial of existence of evil in the world. In other words, what's the only way a human being can intellectually deal with this is to rationalize out evil. It really isn't somehow, perhaps, as we saw it, and there's a bigger perspective of this. However, this is actually a paragraph in between, but I skipped over here. He says, he talks about the man of fate and the man of destiny. He says, this is the question that the man of fate asks. The question of the man of destiny is different. The next paragraph. However, in the realm of destiny, man recognizes reality as it is, and does not desire to use the harmonizing formulas in order to hide it and disregard evil. The child of destiny is very realistic and does not flinch in anticipation of a face-to-face confrontation with evil. His approach is halachic and moral, and thus devoid of any metaphysical or speculative nuance. When the child of destiny suffers, he says in his heart, there is evil, I do not deny it, and I will not conceal it with a fruitless causatory, thank you. I'm however, interested in it from a halachic point of view. And as a person who wants to know what action to take, I ask a single question. What should the sufferer do with his suffering? So the question what he's doing is, Rav Soloveitchik is shifting away from the why into the what. Coming back to the Ponovitch Rav again. The Ponovitch Rav was once asked by a Holocaust survivor, who said, look, we both suffered immensely, we both lost everything, but you continued to build. You know that the Ponovitch Rav died in debt because of all the dreams he built, which he had not yet been able to fund. And as the man said to him, I don't understand. How is it that you could do this, and I, and this person, through his life, was never able to. He was never able to marry, he was never able to rebuild, he was never able to. And understandably so. There was so much suffering that he bore on his shoulders, he could never get to that next step. And so he turned to the Ponovitch Rav, and the Rav said to him, he said, because we asked different questions. When it happened to you and you walked out, you said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why me? And I asked Hashem, why did you choose me? For what reason was I chosen? That's what the Ponovitch Rav said, and that's how he rebuilt. What Soloveitchik says is that, you know what? It would be glib, it would be fruitless to actually say we can even answer the question in the first place. To think that we, you know, ostentatiously and arrogantly could answer on the backs of more than 6 million people, 1.5 million children, no way to answer that question. To gloss over it would be arrogant and would be, in fact, intellectually dishonest. He says, recognize it. But the question we ask is not the why, because we don't have the fathomable, as Rav Almiya tells us at the beginning. We cannot fathom that. We don't understand God. But there is a question we can ask, and that is, what do we do? What practically can we do? That is, and this is the reason why this is so powerful is because, as the Eish Kodesh says, in his brilliance of mind, sitting there in the Warsaw Ghetto in a basement trying to teach Torah, he once said that although it's true that we're suffering immeasurably, he says, but every person, even when they have the hurting on their toenail, when their toenail is broken and is suffering, that suffering can consume a person the same way that the suffering is consuming us. And with the same ways of trying to understand and appreciate what went on is the way we can understand and appreciate the suffering within our lives, even though they are worlds apart. But he was able to give us a Pesach into our own lives in the way of being able to deal with things. And I'd like to just close with the lines that Rav Soloveitchik says, Rabbi Sachs says earlier on, which I skipped over earlier on in our packets. And this is in a book called Crisis and Conversation, or essay called Crisis and Covenants, where he says the following. I'm trying to find it in my own notes over here, towards the beginning. Yeah, I've the more annotated notes over here. Give me a moment. Rav Soloveitchik says the following. I'm just going to have to borrow some of these right for a moment. Thank you so much, because my notes are 56 pages long. So Rav Soloveitchik says says the following in an area called Crisis and Covenants. This is a very thoughtful question. Not to the exclusion of all others, he says, the Holocaust raised in its most acute form the question of the interpretation of suffering. But the founding of the State of Israel in 1948 raised the no less intractable question of the interpretation of redemption. Now, what he's not saying is that 1 and negative 1 equals 0. That would be very callous. What he's saying is that we need to also ask the question of the inexplicable manner of redemption, as inexplicable as the suffering was. We ought to ask both questions to appreciate it. Coming back to Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel was the one who said in that moment in the camp, where is God? God is hanging. In his introduction, in his later introduction, tonight, years later, in his own journey, in processing it, this is what he says back to that child. And this is the last thing we close with in Source 6. Elie Wiesel, an introduction tonight. And yet Zion has risen up again from the crematorium slaughterhouses. The Jewish nation has been resurrected from among its thousands of dead. It is they who have given it new life. We do not know the worth of one single drop of blood, one single tear. All is grace. If the Almighty is the Almighty, the last word for each of us belongs to Him. That is what I should have said to the Jewish child. But all I could do was embrace him and weep. And that was his own journey and his own processing of that, which, lo aleinu, we should never have to face. Again, this is the beginning of a conversation, but I think it's worthwhile from time to time to revisit these issues and to try in our own way to strengthen our own emunah through some of the incredible heroes. So the incredible heroes, some of them we know personally and some of them we know nationally. ויחננו מן הקשר מורה צהר קודש ברוך הוא לזעקו את ישראל לפי חכיר בלעיים תורם את זה שנמר עד נחב עצמן סיכו יגדיל תורה ויעדיר.